copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
We come to the Babylonian exile period, and we have Jeremiah on the map here. Jeremiah prophesied that the people of Judah would be captive in Babylonia for 70 years. And Jeremiah's message, according to the book of Jeremiah, was recorded by a man named Barak, son of Neriah. Well, interestingly, among the scores of these inscribed thumb-sized bulle that have come to light in Jerusalem is one that reads, belonging to Beriah, the son of Neriah, the scribe. The owner is Barak being a shortened version of the same name. His father is Neriah. There's little doubt, really, that this seal impression was made by Jeremiah's scribe. So here is the seal impression of the guy who physically wrote the book of Jeremiah as the scribe for the prophet Jeremiah. So we have a picture of the extent of in orange here, the Babylonian Empire, which Israel is now in exile, and people taken from Jerusalem to Babylon to serve as servants for the state, and particularly here mentioning about Daniel. Now, interestingly, Greek historians had ascribed the building of Babylon to Queen Sammuramat, a queen mother in Assyria, who we now know actually had nothing to do with the building of Babylon. But in the book of Daniel, chapter 4, verse 30, it says, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is this not the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" So it's saying, the Bible here is saying Nebuchadnezzar was the one who's really responsible for the building of the greatness of Babylon, not talking about Queen Sammuramat, as the Greek historians did. Again, Nebuchadnezzar was one of those figures whom we had no extra biblical evidence of, and sort of German 19th century liberal scholars used to say was just a made-up figure. But here we have, for example, a stone mentioning Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, who cares for Esagil and Ezer, eldest son of Nebopolsar, king of Babylon. Or the cylinder of Nebuchadnezzar II, a clay cylinder, cuneiform text all over it, describes three palaces which Nebuchadnezzar built for himself in Babylon. And we've got other references to Nebuchadnezzar in connection with building works. Here we have a little cuneiform thing that mentions one Nebo-Sarskin, chief eunuch of Nebuchadnezzar, a visiting professor from Vienna at the British Museum, discovered this in 2007, just sort of stumbled across it, came across Nabu Shashuka Ukin. Everything gets, the names are described slightly differently in different languages, and there wasn't uniform spelling and things at the time, of course. Described as the chief eunuch of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Professor Giosso, who's an Assyriologist, checked his Old Testament, and in chapter 39 of the book of Jeremiah, he found, albeit spelled slightly differently, the same name, Nebo-Sarskin, and this tablet dated to the 10th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar II, 12 years before the siege of Jerusalem. He said, finding something like this tablet where we see a person mentioned in the Bible making an everyday payment to the temple in Babylon and quoting the exact date is quite extraordinary. King Jehoiachin was taken to Babylon, taken prisoner, and when one evil Merodach, evil not being used in the way that we in English use the word evil, of course, evil Merodach became king of Babylon, he took pity on Jehoiachin and released him from prison. And the biblical text actually mentions that the Babylonian king spoke kindly to Jehoiachin and gave him a more prominent seat than those of the kings who were with him in Babylon. And says that Evil-Merodach gave Jehoiachin a set of provisions, daily provisions. As for his provisions, there was a regular ration given him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life, in 2 Kings 25. Well, here we actually have, in cuneiform, the Babylonian document that lists the provisions that are to be given to King Jehoiakim from the administrative documents. Jehoiakim's name is clearly legible on the tablets, and there's a documentation for an allotment of grain and oil and various foodstuffs that he is to be provided, him and his retinue. Fascinating time. Just this little aside comment in 2 Kings about these rations, and here we have the extra biblical list of the rations that are being provided. This is a seal of Eliakim, steward of Jehoiakim, who's mentioned in 2 Kings 19:2, discovered by William F. Albright in the 1920s. It says on it, the property of Eliakim, steward of Jehoiakim. Now, you know the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of course, and it's difficult to get direct evidence of the really spectacular events of this story, but we do know some of the background. We know that burning as a penalty for crime appears twice in the Code of Hammurabi, set forth by the Babylonian king in the 18th century BC. We know that another early Babylonian monarch called Rimsin also used burning as a form of execution. So it's not too surprising when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are sentenced to a burning execution. There's this report that there's a clay prism that's been found in Babylon that's now meant to be in the Istanbul Museum. That lists names that are very similar to the names of Daniel's three friends, although we can't be certain that they're the actual men mentioned in the Bible. But there are, so there's Ardi-Nabu, official to the royal prince. This name is the equivalent of the Aramaic name Abednego, Ari-Nabu, Abednego, and may in fact be the first mention of one of Daniel's friends from outside the Bible. Another found on this list is Hananu, commander of the king's merchants. And the name Hananu may be the Babylonian equivalent of the Hebrew name Hananiah, and another name found on the list is Michelin Marduk, the Babylonian name, the Babylonian god Marduk, as an official of Nebuchadnezzar. If Marduk is left out of the name, we wind up with Meshalim, which may refer to Mishael, maybe a form of Mishael, Meshach, Mishael, and they've just added Marduk to sort of Babylonianize the name. And the fact that these three names, not only that these three names are similar to these three names in the story, but that the three names are found on the list as officials, which Daniel and his friends were taken to Babylon to be trained as to serve as servants, as officials in the Babylonian court, is suggestive, but of course not conclusive. Now, you know the story of Daniel in the lion's den, of course, and here we have a relief of the British Museum of lion hunting and lions in their lion den here. In ancient Assyria, lion hunting was considered the sport of kings. Today in the UK, the royal family tend to play polo from horseback, but back then it was lion hunting, symbolic of the ruling monarch's duty to protect and fight for the people, so to say. Well, here we have a sculpted relief from the British Museum that illustrates the sporting exploits of the last great Assyrian king, Ashurbanipal, from the 7th century BC, which were created for his palace at Nineveh in modern-day northern Iraq. So the culture at that time, this sort of the previous regime, the Assyrian, before the Babylonian Empire, kings had been the sport of kings to hunt lions. Here's a close-up of a king skewering this rather fearsome-looking lion. He looks very calm about it, doesn't he? So the fact that Nebuchadnezzar would have had a lion den to hand is perhaps not all that culturally surprising. If you've ever thought, you know, how come he throws him to a lion den? Are these like wild lions that they have to kind of go out into the countryside and find some sort of lion den to throw him in? Or it's quite plausible that actually this was like the royal hunting estate, as it were, and they kept lions to be hunted. And that they threw Daniel into this lion's den. So then, right at the end of the exile, we have the famous incident of Belshazzar's feast. Was Belshazzar really king of Babylon, as Daniel 5 claims? Some scholars have said that, in fact, he wasn't king, and use this as evidence that the Book of Daniel is not historically reliable. So Babylonian texts tell us that at the time of the feast story in the Bible, in Daniel, in 539 BC, there was another king, Nabonidus, who was Belshazzar's father. So wouldn't that make Belshazzar the crown prince at the time rather than king? Well, a chap called George Heath White, who was then a final year student in Cambridge University, a student of Assyrian, made an interesting discovery whilst translating some 6th century BC Babylonian tablets for his dissertation. George was following the lives of some Judean exiles in Babylon and came across a character who was given the adopted name of Belshazzar, which means Lord Bel, the god Bel, protect the king. This Babylonian name adoption was a custom for those who worked in the government, as we know from Daniel's case. We're talking about adding God's names to people's names to sort of Babylonianize them and so on. So this Judean Belshazzar appears in three texts, and in the first two he's Belshazzar, but in the third text he's changed, the same guy has changed his name back to one that reflects his Hebrew origins, and Heath White wondered what might have made him want to stop being called Belshazzar. Well, research has also shown that in Babylonian times, you weren't allowed to have the same name as the king. So if you were called Belshazzar, and someone who was also called Belshazzar became king, it was time for you to change your name. And George points out that this Judean government worker may have changed his name for other reasons, but it is pretty plausible that he did so because Nabonidus' son, Belshazzar, really had become king. That would explain everything. But wasn't Nabonidus himself still king? Well, actually, another text, translated by a chap called Gibson, records that in the year 552 BC, Nabonidus had relocated to the Arabian desert and made his son co-regent ruling in Babylon. Now this also explains why Belshazzar offers Daniel the title of third highest in the kingdom. If you look at Daniel 5:16. So third highest in the kingdom after Nabonidus and Belshazzar. Fascinatingly, this year of 552 was the very same year the Judean civil servant changed his name so that he wouldn't be called Belshazzar anymore. This year that we have the record of Nabonidus relocating to the Arabian desert and making his son co-king, co-regent. So that all ties up together. For this research, George received a university award. It's circumstantial evidence, but as he puts it, perhaps if correct, a little bit more evidence to counter the popular opinion that Belshazzar being called king in Daniel 5:1 is an error. He was king, he was a co-regent, he was king even though he was officially second in command, and that's why he can only make Daniel third in command in Daniel 5:16. So Daniel 5:29, then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain placed around his neck, and was proclaimed third highest ruler in the kingdom. So here we have another cuneiform cylinder of Nabonidus, in which King Nabonidus mentions his co-regent, and it mentions Belshazzar, my firstborn son, the offspring of my heart. And cuneiform temple receipts from Sippar also show Belshazzar presenting animals as an offering of the king. So we've got various bits of data from Babylonian sources that all actually tie in and make sense of what's going on in the Daniel story here. And then Babylon falls to King Cyrus of Persia. And here we have a little inscription on one of these little barrels of inscriptions from King Cyrus, a little bit of propaganda talking about, I entered Babylon as a friend and established my royal residence in the palace of the princes amid jubilation and rejoicing. You know, everyone was so happy that I'd conquered them. My numerous troops walked around Babylon in peace, because there was numerous troops. I also restored to the cities on the other side of the Tigris, like the foreigners, their hitherto long-ruined temples. I also gathered up their one-time inhabitants and returned them to their homelands. So he, like the new power, made himself popular by sending home the people who'd been taken into exile, sending them home, saying, you can rebuild your temples and stuff, so long as you all still sort of nominally pay tribute to me and you're sort of under my rulership. And of course, this was the end of the exile, as we've seen, as had been prophesied by Jeremiah. As we tie up and try and draw some conclusions and lessons from what we've seen together here. So share that. Here we go.